fasten your seatbelts.
Part 5, The Road to Orwell, based again on Ian Slater's book Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1, published in 1985. Where we left off in Chapter 10, and I think it gets really, really heavy duty between 10 and 11. This is as good as it gets, I think. All right, in the narrative, Slater writes, "Unlike the needs of the arts, the requirements of science would seem at first to pose a major difficulty, standing in the way of implementing a language of deception, be it newspeak or the jargon-filled oldspeak, which Orwell believed could affect all areas of endeavor. As he points out in The Prevention of Literature, a scientist must be guaranteed a certain amount of intellectual freedom, even in a totalitarian society. Atom bombs cannot be manufactured if the scientist is required, as Winston Smith is, to believe that 2 and 2 make 5. Nevertheless, in a world of superstates, East Asia, Eurasia, and Oceania, science, insofar as it fathers increased production, must be carefully controlled because increased production, which would raise the living standard, is not wanted by the inner party. So long as the people are comfortable, they will not want more consumer goods, which would raise the standard of living. For if leisure and security were enjoyed by all alike, the great mass of human beings who are normally stupefied by poverty would become literate and would learn to think for themselves. They would then, sooner or later, realize that the privileged minority had no function and they would sweep it away. Hence, in a world where it was no longer possible to return to an agricultural past, because, as Orwell noted in The Road to Wigan Pier, the tendency towards mechanization has become quasi-instinctive, the problem was how to keep the wheels of industry turning without increasing the real wealth of the world. It can hardly be argued that this is the problem of present-day governments, totalitarian regimes included, but, and herein lies the popularity of 1984, the psychological climate of a totalitarian state today, and in parentheses, and on occasion, the non-totalitarian state, in the parentheses, strikes us as being remarkably similar to that of 1984. This is because every area of endeavor is brought under control as much to maintain governmental power as to improve the human condition, and often solely to maintain power. In any case, whatever the hidden motives for their power hunger, the inner party of Oceania and the rulers of Eurasia and East Asia do not want to increase production, not even for purposes of war. Like most superpowers today, they already possess enough nuclear weapons to annihilate each other. Because of this capability, the leaders, while they have decided that the answer to the threatening problem of overproduction caused by science is war, have also decided that such conflict, though continuous, must be limited, like a never-ending Vietnam. That's interesting. In this way, the war is not intended to be decisive in terms of permanently changing boundaries. It is in the main not so much a war against an external enemy as one waged by each ruling group against its own subjects. You get that? Your government against you, that's my point. Anyway, all right, whose consciousness the leadership does not want to raise. The slogans of war, apart from evoking images of heroic sacrifice, help to explain away the scarcity of consumer goods. They also channel existing hostilities into permanent war hysteria, and are used to justify the continuous oppression and inequality that are needed to keep the party in power. In this sense, for the party, war is peace. Such continuous war, or at the very least, such continuous war preparation, which the party needs to divert domestic attention away from domestic failure, is more easily maintained by leaders than we think. In Animal Farm, Napoleon appeals to the sense of common good in his followers. Discipline, comrades, iron discipline, that is the watchword for today. One false step, and our enemies would be upon us. Surely, comrades, you do not want Jones back. In 1984, the common enemy is different, but the technique is the same, with Goldstein and his Eurasian hordes being kept permanently in the mind of the public by the Daily Hate. Both leaderships illustrate that they reject what Orwell said was the shallow, hedonistic philosophy of so many leaders who wrongly believe that most people want nothing more than an easy, safe life. The rulers of Animal Farm in 1984. Orwell makes clear, understand what Hitler, Stalin, and Churchill knew, that quite apart from nationalist appeal to the fatherland, Mother Russia, or whatever, human beings, in addition to comfort and pleasure, at least intermittently, want struggle and self-sacrifice, not to mention drums, flags, and loyal parades. Orwell's view here is again an extension of something he wrote in The Road to Wigan Pier, namely that it is only in the face of hardship and pain that claims of victory fulfill our need for the heroic vision. Of course, people do get tired of better an end with horror than a horror without end. And he has in parentheses Hitler. Or blood, sweat, and tears, from Churchill. And for this reason, the inner party is ever predicting that final victory is within sight. Continuous limited war does not mean, however, that total territorial conquest of each other in the future is not desired by the rulers of the superstates. On the contrary, while one of the two aims of the party is to discover through science, against his will, what another person is thinking, the other is how to kill several hundred million people in a few seconds without giving warning beforehand. This will enable the state to satisfy its two basic aims, that of conquering the world and that of extinguishing once and for all the possibility of independent thought. All scientific research in 1984 is dedicated to this end. And although no more A-bombs are dropped because of the possibility of a retaliatory holocaust, all three superstates keep producing and stockpiling A-bombs for the decisive opportunity which they all believe that will come sooner or later. Because of the decisive opportunity theory, the search for new weapons continues unceasingly, even though in 1984, warfare has remained more or less conventional for the past 40 years. Helicopters are more used than they were formerly. Bombing planes have been largely superseded by self-propelled projectiles, but otherwise there has been little development. The problem raised by the increasing search for new weaponry, even within the framework of limited conventional war, however, is that the scientists must still be allowed to work on the belief that two and two make four, that there is an external reality independent of the party. Thus, some independent thought, if not actually encouraged, has to be tolerated even within the boundaries set by the non-nuclear needs of limited war. Still, the party, says Orwell, does exert control insofar as limited war means limited science. The scientist of today is either a mixture of psychologist and inquisitor, studying with real, ordinary minuteness the meaning of facial expressions, gestures, and tones of voice, and testing the truth-producing effects of drugs, shock therapy, hypnosis, and physical torture. Or he is a chemist, physicist, or biologist concerned only with such branches of his special subject as are relevant to the taking of life. And you should know where that comes from in his works. At first sight, such limited science may not seem possible. In view of Orwell's own argument that once one free thought is allowed, others will follow, or conversely, that by removing the taboo on one thought, the logjam of taboos will burst, that a tunnel-visioned science devoted only to war is possible, is evident in Orwell's essay, What is Science? Here we are reminded of the inability of many scientists to hold out against nationalism. He points out, for example, that while Hitler had probably destroyed the long-range promise of science in Germany, there were nevertheless large numbers of German scientists who were very willing to produce the weapons for the Nazi cause, and that without these scientists, Germany's rampage could not have gone as far as it did. The point is simply that although knowledge of objective truth may be allowed to humans, this is no guarantee that the broad worldview this allows will cause them to act humanely rather than surrender themselves to a narrow nationalist view. Of course, as Orwell pointed out in 1945, some do act humanely, taking the wider view and refusing to limit their work to nationalist purpose if their research is aimed toward the destruction of people rather than toward their preservation. By their example alone, such researchers can disseminate the idea of unlimited ideas, of a world free of perverted science. The question for a totalitarian state is how to contain such individuals, how to permit a sense of objective truth to exist among scientists, in parentheses, who, unlike the artists, are considered essential, in parentheses, and yet prevent the growth of a worldview that causes some scientists to perceive the reality beyond that of the party. In 1984, the inner party's answer is to blinker the vision of scientists through controlling their language and thereby their thoughts. This, of course, means the need for a language specially designed for science, called the C vocabulary of Newspeak. While the A vocabulary consists of words that are necessary for business transaction and everyday living, from drinking to riding in the tube, the subway, and the B vocabulary consists of words made to serve the party's political ends, the C vocabulary consists entirely of scientific and technical terms that have been stripped of undesirable meanings. And this is from 1984. Very few of the C words had any currency either in everyday speech or in political speech. Any scientific worker or technician could find all the words he needed in the list devoted to his own speciality, but he seldom had more than a smattering of the words occurring in other lists. Only a very few words were common to all lists, and there was no vocabulary expressing the function of science as a habit of mind or a method of thought, irrespective of its particular branches. There was, indeed, no word for science, any meaning that it could possibly bear being already sufficiently covered by the word ingsoc. Back to Slater. For the party, such a vocabulary, like the other two, is an ideal way of exerting state control over the idea of objective truth. Now, leaks of objective truth do occur, however, even beyond the scientific community. Winston Smith, just once in his life, had possessed, after the event, concrete, unmistakable evidence of an act of falsification, like a fossil bone. He held it, an old newspaper clipping, between his fingers for as long as 30 seconds before he put it in the memory hole in the wall from which a stream of air would transport it to destruction in the great furnaces of the Ministry of Truth. This incident demonstrates the use of newspeak, indeed, of any language. It's not enough in itself to alter the past. The language is merely an auxiliary technique of thought control. Above all else, one has to learn to control one's memory. To make sure that all written records agree with the orthodoxy of the moment is merely a mechanical act, but it is also necessary to remember that events happened in the desired manner. And if it is necessary to rearrange one's memories or to tamper with written records, then it is necessary to forget that one had done so. If one is to succeed in this, the trick, as Smith realizes, is to apply the process of doublethink on itself, that is, to lie to yourself that you are not lying. The process finally becomes intuitive and is similar to trying to think of someone's name. The harder you try, the longer the name will be forgotten. I thought that was advanced age. Anyway, this latter experience is unconscious. But doublethink is a conscious attempt to be unconscious, like thinking of everything at once in order to think of nothing, a case of overload destroying the fuse of memory, which would otherwise illuminate the past. Consequently, you become unconscious of the act of deception just performed. It is an attempt to erase memory, never to forget the inner party's central tenet that the past is infinitely changeable, to believe the party's claim that it invented airplanes, to believe its fantastic claims of overfulfilled production quotas, and thus to believe that reality exists only in the mind of the party and is not external. Smith, however, clinging to his individuality, being the last man, resists the deception of the party, even though he daily becomes part of that deception himself when he casually alters production figures as part of his job at the Ministry of Truth. In particular, he clings to the layman's belief in science, at least in a reality beyond the party, by clinging to memories of natural laws that are not mutable. He recalls, indeed cultivates, the memory that stones are hard, water is wet, objects unsupported fall towards the earth's center. His determination to keep such things firmly in mind while at a desk job is a recognition of Orwell's belief, expressed in The Road to Wigan Pier, that once you stop using your hands, then, with the advance of science, you lose a large part of your consciousness. It was, no doubt, one of the reasons he loved gardening. Winston's spirit of resistance, his quest to assure himself of a reality that is just not just beyond the party, but of another time, is captured in his visit to a small shop in the Prohl Quarter of town. He picks up a lump of glass, at the heart of which there is a strange pink convoluted object. Upon inquiry, Winston discovers that from the old shopkeeper that it is something called coral. What attracts Winston to the object more than its beauty is its uselessness, reminding us of Orwell's declaration that as long as I remain alive, well shall I continue to love the surface of the earth and to take pleasure in solid objects and scraps of useless information. Winston buys a lump of glass immediately. What fascinates him most of all, like the socialist in Wigan Pier who shamefully confessed to Orwell that he liked horses, is the air it seemed to possess of belonging to an age quite different from the present. It was a queer thing, even a compromising thing, for a party member to have in his possession. Anything old, anything beautiful, was always vaguely suspect. Above all, Winston's resistance to the notion that reality is what the party says it is to be is the manifestation of Smith's lingering belief that freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. If that is granted, all else follows. Such resistance is pitted, however, against the subtle arguments of interrogator O'Brien. To the latter's claim that the earth is only as old as the party, Winston protests, arguing that there are bones and fossils long predating people. O'Brien asks, "Have you ever seen those bones, Winston?" "Of course not. 19th century biologists invented them. Outside man, there is nothing." In presenting O'Brien's argument in terms of who has seen the wind, Orwell paradoxically reveals Smith's vulnerability and our vulnerability to unscientific argument through revealing our blind acceptance of a wide range of, quote, scientific facts, unquote, with proofs that lie beyond our relatively narrow experience. He shows how much of what we believe, particularly in science, is accepted on faith, solely on the authority of experts. In this sense, Orwell wrote, "Shaw is right. This is a credulous age." I'm not going to depart much from this, but think about what that said, because of all that's going on now that we do not understand or see or can palpably feel within our own purview of experience, and that is, what are these charges about global warming and all this stuff? I won't go anywhere else with that, but it's just question everything. All right, back to Slater in his book, Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1. Indeed, as early as 1935, Orwell has Dorothy Hare, in A Clergyman's Daughter, entertaining O'Brien's thesis that reality is not external. The truism that all real happenings are in the mind struck her more forcibly than ever before. That Dorothy Hare's truism is so seriously questioned by Winston Smith in 1984, 14 years later, marks a significant maturation in Orwell. It reveals his concern with the ever-present danger that in overemphasizing the cerebral at the expense of the physical, the things we can feel, we run the risk of disbelieving the evidence of our senses, that in the full meaning of the phrase, we lose touch with reality. If this happens, we are already halfway to accepting O'Brien's claim that there is nothing that we could not do. Invisibility, levitation, anything. We make the laws of nature, and that whatever the party holds to be true is truth. I'm sorry for stuttering sometimes. I'm reading very quickly, but this stuff is really getting to me. I mean, when you think about 9/11 also, I mean, we run the risk of disbelieving the evidence of our senses. Alrighty, we'll go on. Picking up the narrative, that Winston Smith is a flaw in the pattern and holds out against such claims, or at least holds out longer than most, is due largely to his inability either to control his thought through doublethink or to break the old habit of thinking in old speak, even though he rewrites history in newspeak. As we have already seen, it is not that he dislikes his work of altering old speak in the ministry of truth. On the contrary, Winston's greatest pleasure in life was in his work. Like Orwell, who had worked in the propaganda section at the BBC and who thought had the regime been devoted to a better cause, he would have enjoyed nothing better than being one of the Gestapo specialists who tracked down authors through painstaking studies of style. Winston finds that, regardless of the purpose of the job, there were jobs so difficult and intricate that you could lose yourself in them. I got to read that again, all right? Like Orwell, who had worked in the propaganda section at the BBC and who thought that had the regime been devoted to a better cause, he would have enjoyed nothing better than being one of the Gestapo specialists who tracked down the authors through painstaking studies of style. Whoa. Okay, we move on. Winston's difficulty, however, is that so long as he clings to the old concept of objective truth rather than the party's stark black-white vision of the world, he cannot willingly give himself over to newspeak. His fellow worker, Syme, warns him of the danger. "You haven't a real appreciation of newspeak, Winston," he said almost sadly. "Even when you write it, you're still thinking in old speak. I've read some of those pieces that you write in the Times occasionally. They're good enough, but they're translations. In your heart, you'd prefer to stick to old speak, with all its vagueness and its useless shades of meaning." Winston knows that Syme is right. Unable to accept the party's concept of reality, he cannot accept its language or Syme's vision that in another 60 years or so, no one will be living who can understand old speak, language as we know it today. Still, the totalitarian state does not maintain total control over dissenting opinions by language alone. When lies fail, there is always terror. Oh, baby. And terror works. Once again, when lies fail, there is always terror. And terror works. This is the lesson with which Orwell, the ex-imperialist policeman and fugitive from the communist police, ends 1984. His point is not that the instigators of terror always win, but they win more often than is generally believed or more often than we want to admit. Quote, "Report yourself. Go report yourself again. I was in a world where it was not possible for me to be good. It was possible to commit a sin without knowing that you committed it, without wanting to commit it, and without being able to avoid it. And whenever one had a chance to suck up, one did suck up, and at the first smile, one's hatred turned into a sort of cringing love. This is not the political prisoner Winston Smith cowering before the party's electric shock, cured by being made sane by O'Brien. It is young Eric Blair being cured of bedwetting at St. Cyprian's, and to this Orwell adds, there was a boy named Beecham, with no brains to speak of, but evidently in acute need of a scholarship. Sambo was flocking him towards the goal as one might do with a foundered horse. He went up for a scholarship at Uppingham, came back with a consciousness of having done badly, and a day or two later received a severe beating for idleness. I wish I'd had that canning before I went up for the exam, he said sadly, a remark which I felt to be contemptible, but which I perfectly well understood. It's a mistake to think such methods do not work. They work very well for their special purpose. The boys themselves believe in its efficacy. Well, that's pretty heavy. All right, moving along. While at times it is risky to try to tie in an author's childhood experience to his or her work as an adult and wrongheaded to confuse all coercion with terror, the passages cited are nevertheless important in following Orwell's concern with the subject of terror. They deserve attention not simply because Such Were the Joys was written 2 years after Animal Farm and shortly before 1984, thus making the connection between his childhood experience and his adult writing more tenable, but because in reflecting the schoolboy's passive acceptance of his lot, they point directly to the psychological background of 1984. They testify to the fact that without a developed sense of history, one is particularly vulnerable to a reign of terror, if for no other reason than that one has no knowledge of anything else. He wrote, "The weakness of the child, like those pupils of Dorothy Hare and the adults of 1984, is that it starts with a blank sheet. It neither understands nor questions the society in which it lives. Other people can work upon it, infecting it with the same sense of inferiority and the dread of offending against mysterious, terrible laws. We recall that Orwell also wrote of his own school days at St. Cyprian's, quote, "I did not question the prevailing standards. There were no others," end of quote. As we saw earlier, it is precisely because of the lack of standards of comparison that the pros fail to realize that they were oppressed. In such circumstances, it is hardly surprising that the men of terror win, not now and then, here and there, but everywhere and always. For a people devoid of history is a people unused to the idea, the very idea of change, let alone revolt. Nevertheless, despite all the awesome evidence of perverted power about him, Winston Smith continues to resist, and this is what makes him exceptional, then finally heroic. Daily aware of the highly disciplined, institutionalized attack by the party on the concept of objective truth, which differs from the haphazard, involuntary attack that Orwell believed was launched by the intellectuals in the 30s, Winston Smith, having resisted the techniques of deception, now resists the techniques of sheer terror. He does so despite his knowledge that as a member of the party, his whole life is under the watchful gaze of thought police. He can resist, at least for a time, because he draws strength from the belief, held earlier by Dorothy Hare in A Clergyman's Daughter, that whatever happens externally, even when you're practically starving, it doesn't change anything inside you. Thus he believes that the inner heart, whose workings were mysterious even to yourself, remain impregnable. Iron bars may end your political freedom, but your metaphysical freedom, the freedom to think what you will inside the cell, is indestructible. O'Brien destroys this inner freedom, however, and it is this that is the ultimate nightmare, the final tragedy of 1984. The method O'Brien uses to break Winston, parentheses, because it is intolerable to us, the party, that an erroneous thought should exist anywhere in the world, and the parentheses, is yet another extension of the party's attack upon the concept of external reality beyond the party. While there is nothing new in terror being used as a means of coercion, the new and terrifying element in Oceania is that terror is constant. It is constant because there is no distinction made between the dissenting thought and the dissenting act. Thought crime, or in newspeak, crime think, means death. The techniques of terror in Orwell's last work, such as the Daily Hate Session, are new only insofar as they employ the latest gadgetry of a perverted science. As the following passages show, 1984 is merely the culmination of Orwell's concern that the power of orthodoxy, aided by increasing centralization in science, would eventually smother the individual. And here we go to excerpts. It was a voice that sounded as if it could go on for a fortnight without stopping. It's a ghastly thing, really, to have a sort of human barrel organ shooting propaganda at you by the hour. The same thing over and over again. Hate. 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 Let's all get together and have a good hate. Over and over. It gives you the feeling that something has got inside your skull and is hammering down on your brain. But for a moment, with my eyes shut, I managed to turn the tables on him. I got inside his skull. I felt what he was feeling. Smash. Right in the middle. The bones cave in like an eggshell. And what was a face a minute ago is just a great big blob of strawberry jam. Smash. There goes another. That's what's in his mind, waking and sleeping, and the more he thinks of it, the more he likes it. The world we're going down into, the kind of hate world, slogan world, it is the world of the rubber truncheons, the secret cells where the electric light burns night and day and the detectives watching you while you sleep. The processions and the posters with enormous faces, and the crowds of a million people all cheering for the leader till they deafen themselves into thinking that they really worship him, and all the time, underneath, they hate him so that they want to puke. I love that kind of talk. All right, back to Slater. This is not Winston Smith in 1984, but George Bowling speaking in England just before the Second World War. Following is Winston Smith in Oceania in the afterwar. The next moment, a hideous grinding speech as of monstrous machine running without oil bursts from the telescreen at the end of the room. The hate had started. Now, here we go to the excerpt. In its second minute, the hate rose to a frenzy. In a lucid moment, Winston found that he was shouting with the others and kicking his heel against the rung of the chair. it was impossible to avoid joining in, a hideous ecstasy of fear and vindictiveness, a desire to kill, to torture, to smash faces in with a sledgehammer, turning one even against one's will into a grimacing, screaming lunatic. And yet the rage that one felt was an abstract, undirected emotion which could be switched from one object to another like the flame of a blow lamp. At one moment, Winston's hatred was not turned against Goldstein at all, but on the contrary, against Big Brother, the party, the thought police. Yet the very next instant, his secret loathing of Big Brother changed into adoration. Despite their similarity, these passages also show that while the gadgetry of science may coerce, it is, in the final analysis, unreliable as a means of permanent conversion. For quite naturally, there is the tendency of victims to turn periodically against their indoctrinators or torturers. In order for the totalitarian party's members to feel totally secure, they must have total conversion. This, as O'Brien knows, involves near-total removal from external reality, so that contrary to Wisdom's belief in its inviolability, the will, the inner private self, can be broken down as much as the body. So long as the mind has some evidence of reality beyond the party, it has a saving point on which to focus amid the vertigo of drugs and electric shock. Whew. In describing this process of breaking a prisoner down, which begins for Winston at the moment of arrest, Orwell once again demonstrates his grasp of the concrete details of subjugation. The moment Winston and his girlfriend Julia are arrested by the thought police in the old pawn shop, which they had thought was a hideaway from party surveillance, we are given an unmistakable sign that Winston, the last man, the last autonomous individual, is doomed. His end is signaled when the glass paperweight with the piece of coral embedded in it is smashed by one of the policemen. As the coral, a tiny crinkle of pink, rolls across the floor, Winston thinks how small it always was. Having failed previously in a conversation with an old pro to capture a sense of a past that was so different from existence under the party, Winston had found in the paperweight a visible and solid reminder of that past. Its very existence, solid evidence of an alternative way of life, had refuted the party's claim that the only reality was theirs and that it existed only in the present. Now the tangible representation of another reality is broken. It is the first step in breaking Winston, because it is a break with the past. The second step is for O'Brien to follow the rule of thumb for all police, isolation of the prisoner. In this case, Smith, after having been taken from a large common cell, is put into a high-ceilinged, windowless confinement chamber with glittering walls where, as Bowling predicted, the light burns constantly, quickly removing one in turn there, even farther from a sense of external reality through eliminating the distinction between night and day. He did not know where he was. Presumably he was in the Ministry of Love, but there was no way of making certain. There were four telescreens, one in each wall. It might be 24 hours since he had eaten. It might be 36. He still did not know, probably never would know, whether it had been morning or evening when they arrested him. And finally, folks, before the final isolation, some other party members, now prisoners, pass through the common cell, but their confusion about time only adds to Winston's. Indeed, their passage further isolates him psychologically. When Ampleforth, the poet, is brought in, Winston asks him what he has done. Ampleforth answers, "There is only one offense, is there not?" Likewise, when Parsons, Winston's dim-witted fellow tenor from Victory Mansions, is brought in and Winston asks what he has been arrested for, Parsons quickly replies, "Thought crime." The two most striking things about the new political prisoners are Ampleforth's ready acceptance of the charge, as if it were as legitimate as a non-political charge, such as murder, and Parsons' abject servility. All right, that's where we're going to end it right now. This is the fifth part of the series on The Road to Orwell. Thank you for being with us.